Let's chase after some summer fun now on our Holiday Road series. Occasionally this summer, we're going to bring you some strangely specific museums from across the country. They're all real, open to the public, and, it must be said, a bit bizarre. Today, we pay homage to a condiment that helps give summer its distinctive flavor.
I am Barry Levinson. I'm the curator and CMO, Chief Mustard Officer here at the National Mustard Museum in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Barry Levinson created the National Mustard Museum in a fit of despair back in 1986.
My beloved Boston Red Sox lost the World Series, decided I needed a hobby to get over my depression. That's the morning I began collecting jars of mustard.
And Levinson, who's a lawyer by trade, quickly saw his hobby turn into an obsession with collecting the different jars wherever he spotted them.
I argued a case at the U.S. Supreme Court. On my way to the court, I saw this little jar of mustard on a discarded room service tray. I didn't have time to go back to my room, so I brought it with me and argued it, and I had a jar of mustard in my pocket.
He won that case, by the way, but he now dedicates his time to collecting condiments professionally. His collection has grown to more than 5,000 mustards from around the globe, everything from French stone ground to French's classic yellow. All are on display at the National Mustard Museum. And there is one more thing. The museum doubles as an institute of higher learning.
It is a hallowed campus of the Mustard College, which everyone knows is poop on you.
And while you cannot take any classes for academic credit at the Mustard College, they do have a nifty fight song.
On our hot dogs, on our bratwurst, mustard is so cool. Never mayo, never ketchup, they're against the rules. Gleaming gold and mellow yellow, smooth, rough, sweet, and hot. Fight, poop on you, we'll fight and eat some lunch.
Keep that song in mind because you can pay a virtual visit to the National Mustard Museum at our website, npr.org. And if you have a suggestion for other strangely specific museums, drop us a note on our comments page. Most Americans who suffer cardiac arrest do not get prompt CPR, and that's one of the reasons that in some places survival rates are less than 10%. To do better, some U.S. cities are pushing a new type of CPR. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
The new CPR doesn't require special skills or training. It also doesn't involve mouth-to-mouth contact. All you have to do is push on the chest to keep the blood flowing until emergency medical technicians arrive. That means it's a lot easier for the EMTs who answer 911 calls to coach people in how to do it over the phone.
All right, hello, your mom.
Like this episode, a woman in Boston has called 911 to say that her mother stopped breathing.
Stopped breathing?
Yeah.
All right, well then, she stopped breathing. I need somebody to do CPR. So I only need one person.
Okay.
The call taker, an EMT, coaches the woman on how to resuscitate her 76-year-old mother.
All right, well then, I'm going to need you to put away your flat on the bed and start CPR.
All right.
One hand on top of the other, front of her chest, between her nipples, and press down.
Okay.
All right, now I'm going to need you to do that 30 times.
It seems to be working.
She's breathing.
If she's breathing, I don't want you doing CPR. If she's not breathing, I need you to do CPR.
Pressing on the chest isn't a good idea when somebody's breathing on their own. But the woman stops breathing again, so the EMT tells the daughter to go back to pushing on the chest. A minute later, EMTs arrive and take over. Joe O'Hare says this is exactly how he'd like to see every case work. He's deputy superintendent of Boston's Emergency Medical Services.
The patient survived, went home with good cerebral performance, as far as we know. So that CPR probably saved that woman's life, so she did well.
This could happen a lot more often. Most of the time somebody has a cardiac arrest, there's somebody who could help until the EMTs arrive, but bystanders do CPR only about 25% of the time. Partly that's because many people aren't comfortable with the mouth-to-mouth part called rescue breathing. Dr. Thomas Ray of the Seattle King County Health Department says streamlining CPR may save many more lives.
Rates of bystander CPR haven't changed a great deal in most communities in the last decade or two. By making it simpler, maybe we can move that needle a little bit.
It's begun to work in Seattle. There, 911 dispatchers have been pushing the new CPR for the past year with good results.
We saw that bystanders were more likely to get CPR started when the instructions were just chest compressions as opposed to chest compression plus rescue breathing.
Ray led a study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine that compared nearly 1,000 cardiac arrest victims who got traditional CPR from bystanders versus 1,000 who got the new style CPR. There was no difference in survival, around 11 or 12% in each group. That's not great, but Ray thinks a big difference will come if more bystanders are willing to do the new CPR, and he thinks more 911 dispatchers will be able to convince them to try.
A dispatcher can say, "I'm going to tell you exactly what to do. Let's get started." An assertive, confident dispatcher can make a world of difference. I mean, they can save lives.
A similar study from Sweden also shows the new CPR is just as good. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
We may be well into 2010, but the music of our next guest brings to mind a much earlier time. With Brill Cream in his neatly parted hair, wearing a vintage suit jacket and high-waisted pants, Frank Fairfield plays old-style American folk with mesmerizing intensity.
Cumberland Gap's not my home. I'm gonna leave old Cumberland alone.
Fairfield is just 24 years old and from California's Central Valley, not Appalachia. He'd wander the state playing his fiddle, banjo, and guitar for an extra buck.
I like playing on the street because that's where everybody is. You're playing for everybody. You're playing for the old men and the little kids and the people walking out of the liquor store and the people getting out of church.
The street is where he was discovered, performing at a farmer's market in Hollywood. Frank Fairfield's debut album came out last fall. Now he's touring the U.S. and Europe. He joined us from our New York studio. Let me ask you about the banjo as an instrument. You mentioned the banjo to people, and they love it or they hate it before they even hear a note. What is it about the instrument that prompts such strong reactions?
I don't know. I hate to say it, but I think it's been driven into muck. Now they've got plastic heads on them and people playing with all these metal plicks on their fingers, and all you hear is tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick, and, you know, twang-twang-tween-twang. Of course people don't like it. I think the banjo can be such a sweet, warm instrument.
I'm assuming you have your banjo there.
Yes, sir.
Can you give us maybe just kind of a little sense of your sound?
You want me to play the banjo for a little bit?
Yeah.
Oh.
What is that?
Any old thing, I guess. That's just banging on the banjo a little bit.
You have a single CD out called Frank Fairfield. The first song is what is often credited to be a Merle Travis song. Let's hear Merle Travis first.
This 9-pound hammer is a little too heavy for my size. Only for my size.
Let's hear some of your version of it here.
9-pound hammer, just a little too heavy for my size, baby, for my size.
It sounds very old. It sounds actually more ancient than the Merle Travis version that we just heard.
I never heard that version before. I never heard Merle Travis. Various forms of a song called 9-Pound Hammer was written probably when Merle Travis was, 13 years old or 10 years old. All the songs on that first record are just standards, just the ones that everybody knows, real common songs. There's no curveballs in there at all.
There's a pretty one that reminds me of a Jimmy Rogers song. I don't know if it is or not.
Which one?
The Train That Took My Girl from Town.
Yeah, I guess he did sing a lot about trains. I find myself singing a lot about trains. I don't know why. I guess it's just something kind of romantic about, you know, getting away, and I certainly have spent a lot of time with that.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it.
Tennessee raised Alabama, found if the girl leaves me, gonna move from town. Hey, Lord, ain't that passing train, camera girl from town. Well, you and the train left town, don't stand on the corner, it a hanging down. Hey, Lord, ain't that passing train, camera girl from town.
I think that one gets mostly credited to Frank Hutchinson. I hate giving credit to any of this because, nothing really comes from anywhere. And if Frank Hutchinson wasn't out there smoking a cigarette, wearing a beret, making up writing this fine poetry out and taking himself a little seriously, if he even was. And these are just things that have been floating around forever, and he just, had a song to sing and he put it on a record. I don't know what it is.
And do you write songs on your own?
I don't know if I'd call it that, but, maybe I piece together a thing or two or mash up one thing with another or kind of make something up, but I wouldn't call it songwriting. Ira Gershwin was a songwriter. I'm just a kid that sings songs.
Can we get you to play one of your own mashups?
Okay. It does have some train references.
Some people might hear your music and think it's kind of this nostalgic trip back to a certain time, to a certain place. Are they getting the wrong impression if that's their take on it?
Well, even if it was, I don't. People have been nostalgic ever since there ever has been. I mean, a lot of the songs in the American repertoire was written by people in the 1870s that were nostalgic for the good old days, and that's why they wrote songs about the sweet sunny South and Dixie and Suwannee River. To me, it's all the same. I don't, people talk about the past. This is all the same stuff right here all the time. It's nothing goes anywhere. I want to continue playing the music that people used to play before it got cast aside, and this is the most natural place to go from. This is about where things left off, and I'm just picking up where it left off and just keep playing and see what happens from there.
Frank Fairfield, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, certainly.
Frank Fairfield is currently on tour. He recently released a compilation album of 78s from all over the world called The Unheard Ofs and Forgotten Abouts. You can hear more of what Frank Fairfield played for us at nprmusic.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Federal agents recently arrested more than 24 men belonging to the Outlaws Motorcycle Club. Authorities say the club is a criminal gang, and those arrested have been charged with weapons and racketeering offenses. NPR's Kerry Johnson tells us about the violent lifestyle of one of the country's biggest gangs.
Motorcycle gangs don't usually get much attention, aside from a late-night cable TV show called Sons of Anarchy, where gang leader Sam Crow never takes guff from anyone.
Let me be real clear. Nobody threatens Sam Crow, and nobody tells us what we can and can't do.
But far away from TV screens, investigators are working to infiltrate the closed societies of biker gangs and bring criminal cases against their leaders. Rich Marianos works for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and he supervised the outlaw case.
This group was a calculated criminal enterprise that was involved in trying to take over territory, narcotics routes, gambling establishments, and to utilize the brand of the outlaws to facilitate criminal acts of not only themselves but other clubs.
Members of the Outlaws follow a few simple rules. They have to be men, over age 21, and they need to ride American-made motorcycles, Harley-Davidson, all the way. They meet regularly and pay dues, usually $100 a month, to cover legal bills and funeral expenses. Terry Katz investigates biker gangs. He says guys who follow biker culture often pay with their blood.
It's a very, very violent existence. You're either going to die from a motorcycle wreck or from a rival gang. You're going to go to jail, usually for substantial periods of time. For them, they live for the moment. They would rather live a life of sex, parties, being treated like a celebrity for moments rather than have a long-term plan of retirement.
New members work their way into the club by serving a kind of probationary period, running errands and sometimes breaking the law. Neil McBride is the U.S. attorney in Eastern Virginia, and he says outlaws recognize each other through tattoos and patches they wear on their leather vests.
One example is a patch with the letters GFOD, which signifies God forgives, outlaws don't. Another patch they use reads, snitches are a dying breed, which signifies the gang's commitment to identify, expel, and if necessary, murder individuals associated with the club who cooperate with law enforcement.
Earlier this year, outlaw Mark Lester told a TV station in Knoxville, Tennessee, that he has a right to meet and ride bikes with his friends.
None of us are doing anything illegal. We're not a gang, we're a club. We ride and have fun together, and that's what the organization is put together to do, is to have charitable events, help the community, and that's what we've been doing.
Lester's one of several former outlaw leaders arrested this summer. He's now living in a Richmond jail while he and the others await trial. In all, the Outlaws boast more than 1,500 members across the U.S. and a dozen different countries. Investigators say it's usually too dangerous to rely on gang members to build a case. Instead, they try to plant undercover agents to go along for the ride. That's what happened in the Virginia case against the Outlaws. Several undercover operatives became full-fledged members of the gang. They recorded conversations and tipped off police about violent confrontations in the works. Edgar Dominich leads the ATF's Washington office.
It only works when you have law enforcement undercover agents involved from the very inception.
The strategy poses some risks. Terry Katz, the longtime gang investigator, says biker gangs have gotten sophisticated. Some use polygraphs and private investigators to check out new members.
More and more, they become to rely almost the way industry does on background investigations. And certainly with the internet, it's easier to get a lot of information very quickly on an individual than it was when I did it.
Prosecutor Neil McBride says the gangs pose a threat to public safety.
The press recently reported in New Hampshire the shooting of a teenage boy at a pizza joint who was caught in the crossfire between the Outlaws and other motorcycle gang members.
Investigators are still combing through assault weapons, pipe bomb manuals, and Nazi flags they say they uncovered in searches of outlaw property. The ATF says more charges are likely before the Outlaws' trial in October. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
China's legal system is a mix of new laws and old customs. As recently as a generation ago, the country didn't even have trial lawyers or a criminal code. But there are many instances in which the laws put on the books in recent years don't have much effect, and society runs according to a completely different set of unwritten rules. Some Chinese call these hidden rules. In the first of two reports, NPR's Anthony Kuhn looks at how some hidden rules are enforced through a system of so-called black jails.
Just a couple minutes' walk from one of Beijing's busiest downtown intersections, there's a small hotel run by the government of South China's Guangxi province. Provincial officials occasionally use the hotel to secretly detain people who've come to the capital to complain about local government abuses. They're kept here under a sort of house arrest until they can be shipped home. I've been tipped off by a human rights activist that a woman named Liu Xinyu is in just such a jam. She's come to Beijing to complain that her ancestral home was bulldozed by a developer without paying her a fair price.
Liu Xinyu, 在吗?
哎,你好。你好。哎。
I find Ms. Liu in the hall outside her hotel room. Next to her are two sullen and bewildered-looking young women who Liu says were hired to guard her. We ignore them and go into Ms. Liu's room to talk.
I was brought here by people sent by the provincial government to stop me from petitioning. I haven't exactly been detained here, but I'm not free, and they won't let me leave.
We decide to see what happens if she tries. The answer comes soon enough as we make our way to the door. You'd best leave this matter to us, a middle-aged official in the hallway objects. He dodges my microphone and refuses to answer questions. China is different, he insists. We have our regulations here. We make it to the street, heading for a drugstore, with the official trailing not far behind. Liu eventually returns to the hotel, clinging to hope that the government will help her. Miss Liu's hotel is a minimum security facility. There are other makeshift detention facilities in places like rented farmyards and guest houses that are better guarded. China has denied the existence of black jails to the UN Human Rights Commission, but almost any petitioner can show you one. Chinese law gives citizens the right to petition their government to redress their grievances. But petitioners say the government treats them like outlaws. And they say police are often complicit in the black jail's operation. Zhao Fusheng, who's from Sichuan province, says he was detained in his provincial government's liaison office when he came to Beijing to file a petition. He says it was impossible to tell that it was a black jail from the outside.
Once the provincial liaison officials get a hold of you, they put you in their basement. Above the basement is a storefront. A door in the storefront opens, they throw you inside, and you're behind a layer of guards. If you disobey, they beat you.
Zhao says black jails have become a kind of cottage industry in Beijing.
The provincial liaison offices pay the black jail operators the equivalent of $36 per detainee per day. Of that, about 15 goes to hire a guard, another 15 for food, and the rest for accommodations.
Joshua Rosenzweig is the Hong Kong-based research manager for a human rights group called the Dui Hua Foundation. He says that while the central government wants citizens to inform on corrupt officials, it also expects local officials to maintain order and to keep petitioners out of the capital.
If you have petitioners from your area flocking to Beijing, it's a sign that you're not doing your job very well at the local level. And therefore, as a local official, you're going to do everything you can to stop those people from making you look bad.
Many local governments also maintain informal detention centers. Petitioner Jin Hanyan from central Hubei province says she accused her county's Communist Party secretary of corruption. For this, she says she was sent to a so-called study class in an abandoned tobacco factory. Of course, she says, no studying actually went on in there.
In the mornings, they'd yell to wake us up. They'd make us do calisthenics and pull weeds. If you didn't obey, they'd beat you to within an inch of your life and withhold medical treatment if you got sick. They said the county party secretary told them it was not illegal to beat us to death.
Beijing-based journalist Wu Si is the author of the 2002 book Hidden Rules. Government censors banned the book. But society now widely uses the term Wu coined to describe the way things really work in China. Wu says that the black jails are an expression of these hidden rules.
There have been many of these kinds of places, both in China's history and in the present day. They're an expression of officials' power to legally harm citizens. I call them gray jails. They're neither formal jails nor something that is entirely illegal. They're an oddity that exists in a sort of gray area.
Wu says this is the hidden rule that makes all the others stick. Officials have the power to punish citizens, more or less at will, either for challenging their authority or just to extort money out of them. China is certainly not the only society with hidden rules, but China's are especially elaborate. They're also in glaring conflict with the country's laws and with the Confucian virtues that centuries of Chinese governments have espoused.
The formal rules used to say that county officials should act like people's parents In fact, they act like masters and lord it over the common people. Those beneath them must show deference, kowtow before them, and offer them all sorts of goods and favors.
A few days after I talked to her, I got word that local human rights activists had liberated petitioner Liu Xinyu from her hotel room. So I went to see her again. She stands outside the hotel room and reflects on her experience. She says she now sees her former captors as pathetic.
If the local government would just try to resolve our problems for us, then we wouldn't have to petition the higher authorities. There was a time when we trusted the government to resolve our problems, but they didn't respond with sincerity.
The Duihua Foundation's Joshua Rosenzweig points out that local officials could strike at the root of the problem by resolving petitioners' problems. But unfortunately, that's not the way the hidden rules work. And for that reason, the officials just devote their energies to silencing the petitioners. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
When it comes time for the payout on a life insurance policy, most people probably imagine it to be a one-time lump sum check from the insurance company. But that's not always true. Some big insurers have figured out how to delay making the full payout. The practice was first reported by David Evans for Bloomberg Markets Magazine and was on NPR's All Things Considered last evening.
It works like this. When a policyholder dies, major insurers like MetLife and Prudential immediately send a checkbook to the beneficiary. The checks are tied to something called a retained asset account. But the money in the account stays in the insurer's company's coffers, not in a bank. And so those checks are not really checks. They're drafts for money that the insurance company holds and, this is key, earns interest on.
Jeffrey Stemple, a law professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, says these accounts carry some risk and are a disservice to policyholders.
The retained asset accounts are a way of basically keeping the money and earning 5% and paying 0.5% to the beneficiary. It's a ripoff, and it's a ripoff that's inconsistent with the life insurer's duties to the beneficiary.
You mentioned that the accounts are unsafe. How so?
You know, when I say unsafe, I don't want to suggest that they're, you know, teetering on the brink of complete failure. They're not as safe as an FDIC bank account. And 5 will get you 10, that 99% of anybody who has these things thinks that they have the protection that they would have if they had the money in a banking checking account. And that's simply not the case. It's not risk-free. Neither is banking, but at least you have the FDIC and other government programs to essentially reduce that risk to almost nothing. You don't have those same protections in an insurance company's retained asset account.
It sounds like you're saying we have a regulatory gap here, that there's oversight that just isn't being done.
I think that's right, and it's mostly state-oriented in insurance, but the state commissioners often don't have the resources to keep up, which is why the insurer's duty of good faith should be taken seriously. The insurance industry shouldn't be out there trying to stay one step ahead of the regulators in order to extract an extra buck out of the policyholders. They should be acting more honorably. That said, you can't always count on that, and I think we need to invest more effort in more stringent regulation at the state level, but in the event that fails, litigation might be an effective way of doing this. I know that's not a fashionable thing to say now, but if a life insurer like MetLife or Prudential lost a big class action suit, that would get their attention pretty quickly.
How do you know if this is the kind of account you might have?
Well, if I were a beneficiary, I think what I would do immediately, regardless of the kind of account, is I would take whatever funds that I am owed by an insurance company and I would put them in a standard financial institution, and I would consult with my own investment advisor about how best to deploy those funds. You can certainly do much better than the retained asset account by simply putting that money in an FDIC-insured jumbo savings account.
According to reports, major insurers are sitting on some $28 billion still owed to survivors in these kinds of accounts. What guarantee do we have that if everybody starts pulling their money out, saying, I want the lump sum now, that insurers can cover it?
Well, the run on the bank sort of scenario, I think, is unlikely because by definition, these insurance companies should have the reserves. Remember, these life insurers have had that money available. They could have cut those checks years ago. And if they're still sitting in the insurance company coffers, they should still be there. This isn't the type of situation as a bank, as you know, never has its full assets in the bank because they're out on loans and things like that as well. With the life insurers, that money should be available in relatively liquid form. And I should add, if I'm, die and come back and have to be an insurance company, I want to be a life insurance company. They've got good profit ratios. They're in many ways the easiest type of insurance business to run because the mortality tables are much more predictable than the hurricane season or things like that. So life insurers should have the financial wherewithal to honor any demands.
That's Jeffrey Stemple of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Prudential Life Insurance issued a statement yesterday saying, quote, "We firmly believe that our interest-bearing account is a convenient and flexible way for beneficiaries to safeguard and access their money. We fully disclose the nature and terms of the account to account holders, including the interest credited to the account." You can read the full responses from Prudential and MetLife at our website, npr.org.